For decades, some intellectuals have maintained that important parts of human life are just social constructions. What they often seem to mean was that those parts of human life are completely invented by human beings and that there's no objective fact about who's right and who's wrong. For instance, social constructivists have maintained that ethics is just a social construction and that no one's ethical code is more right or wrong than anyone else's. Sometimes they've said that the scientific method is a social construction and that other methods of investigation are no better or worse. At the extreme, they've maintained that all of life is a social construction. We each invent our own way of seeing the world, they think, but there aren't any facts out there at all. These extreme forms of social construction are more than a little strange, but they've had a huge influence on intellectual thought. So let's have a look at them. What is social constructionism really? Why do some people find it appealing? And what role is it playing right now, especially in contemporary politics? I'm Alex Racy, and here with me is John Farrell. Hey, John.
Sir.
How you doing?
Very well, and you, sir?
I'm doing just fine. Glad to be here. Always glad to be podcasting. Before we get going, we should give a little credit. First of all, we should thank some people who are listening to the podcast. We should thank everyone who's listening to it. But we do hear from people from time to time. My old friend Matt from Bowdoin wrote in. So thanks, Matt, for listening. And he sent his brother the podcast about your book. So Chris, thanks for listening to that. And you had some friends of yours write in, Henry, I think. And
yes, indeed. Robert Dossler.
Yeah. So
thanks to everybody for giving us some good feedback.
Right.
And various other people I don't know as well.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Another part of the credit that we should give out goes to the Slate Culture Gabfest, which is another podcast I listen to and that I recommend to everyone, because we got the idea for this podcast from a recommendation given out on the Slate Culture Gabfest. One of the hosts, Stephen Metcalf, recommended that everybody read an article by the philosopher Bruno Latour, an article called Why Has Critique Run Out of Steam, that was written around 2005. And Latour is a social constructivist, and you and I went and read that article, and that got us going on this whole topic. I think we like the Latour article less than Stephen Metcalf did, but still it's available. People could go read it if they want. And in any case, we're grateful to the Slate Culture Gabfest and to Latour for getting us onto this subject. Well, let's talk about it a little bit. I feel like the one piece of background we have to have is we have to know what people mean when they talk about social constructs. So I think when people talk about social constructions or when they label things a social construct, what they mean is that there's this thing that we've thought is a fact out there in the world, independent of human beings. So it's thought to be an unalterable fact. But when you call it a social construct, what you're saying is, in fact, that this truth or this fact is created by human beings themselves. Now, that's very abstract, but I think a very good example of this would be etiquette. The rules of etiquette are not given to us by the world, fixed by the world. They're things we invent, so different cultures can invent different rules. If you want to know whether it's rude to eat with your hands, for example, well, it just depends on what people around you have decided. In some cultures, that's considered rude, and in some, it's not considered rude. And so etiquette would be an example of a set of rules that's just a social construct. And another thing that's nice about this example is it shows that all of us believe that some things are social constructs. And that alone doesn't make you a social constructivist, because it's just a fact that some things are socially constructed. What makes you a social constructivist is if you take this idea that something is a social construct and you apply it to certain controversial areas of human life. So, for instance, some social constructivists have maintained that all of ethics is a social construct. So no ethical code is better or worse than any other. It's just a set of made-up rules like etiquette. And nobody's moral rules are right or wrong, they've said, just in the same way that nobody's etiquette is right or wrong. So that's one area you can apply social constructivism to that makes you a real social constructivist, where you're Yes. taking up a controversial position. Another one that's kind of prominent and that Latour talks about is the idea that the scientific method is a social construct. And I guess the idea here is that the scientific way of gaining knowledge or information is just something people have invented, and it's no better or worse than any other method of coming to believe something or gathering information. And then I guess finally, the most extreme form of social constructivism would be one where you claim that everything is a social construct. So there are no facts at all about anything, and we all just have our own ways of seeing the world, and no one is more right or wrong than anyone else. So does that fit with your understanding of what a social constructivist position would be?
Yes, I very much so. The examples you gave are a little different from each other in a way that's good to point out, I think, which is that some of them are about simply how we regulate things that happen anyway. So things like etiquette tell you how you should behave at the table and that kind of thing. And you're going to be at the table and behave some way, and it tells you that one way is better than another.
Right.
And this is the same with ethics. But then the stronger version of social construction is that it's not just that the construct regulates something, but that it actually creates it, right? That it constitutes it in just the same way that the rules of a game make the game.
Right, and the more extreme version of social constructivism is a form of that sort, right?
Yes.
So when you're a social constructivist about everything, you think that in some way or other the human mind is just creating reality.
That's right, like a game. And if you think of all of life that way, including the very physical world, as something that's been made up, constructed, then that's a strange way of thinking, but that's basically the constructivist attitude.
Right. Well, maybe we should get into what there is to say in favor of this view or why people believe it.
Well, there are so many things that one could talk about in this regard, because almost all of modern culture has, in a way, pointed in this direction. One of them is that in the late Middle Ages, people started thinking very much about the power of God and whether God could do anything. And you may have thought that, you know, 1 + 1 has to equal 2.
Right.
Or the laws of logic, the rules of logic, are things that we simply can't doubt or undermine, right? But is God himself bound by any kind of sense of truth that's apart from his will?
Right. And they were wondering this because that seems like a limitation on God's power.
Yes. It seemed like somebody was telling God that he couldn't do what he wanted to do, right? So God could have made things like cannibalism and incest the highest forms of ethical aspiration, according to that way of thinking. And
he could have made 1 + 1 = 3, according to this way of thinking.
Exactly.
If nothing can limit him, he could do anything.
Uh-huh. That's right. And that was something you had to accept about God. Well, if that's the way you start thinking about the relation between intellect and will, then gradually that may percolate down to your thinking about the human will.
I see. If you're thinking of God as having this enormous power to shape reality with his mind,
yes,
through his will, and then somehow this filters down to the idea that maybe human beings can do that too, something like that? See, I would have thought in the Middle Ages, actually, they would have gone in the opposite direction, which is they would have said God's power is unlimited, so he can change all these truths. But it seems odd that they ever would have toyed with the idea that humans can do it, because I would have thought that their religious views at the time would have made human beings particularly powerless in this regard.
Well, that was the original direction of it.
I see.
And that was the main focus of the Reformation, right? That Luther and Calvin, their main thrust is that human beings have no freedom and no value at all, aside from God. But then you get this way of thinking, it spreads, and people like Hobbes are very much affected by it, even Descartes, right, who's not in that mode of absolute submission. He's a Catholic and is doing a lot to try to establish some kind of ground for the intellect apart from God. So it spreads beyond into a secular mode.
So it's not so much that there was like a logical deduction, well, God can do anything, so humans can do anything. It's more, you're saying, the idea that people sort of latched onto this whole possibility that mind could have control over reality, and then people begin to play around with it, and eventually somebody has the idea, well, maybe it's not only God's mind that can have this huge influence on reality, but human minds too.
That's right. And if you take that far enough, then you get to the constructivist position, where everything is a construction. Everything is arbitrary. And if you are living in a world where you take facts on faith, then you're essentially entrapped by constructions that other people have made for their own satisfaction.
Right, because you're going to view the world in one way. You've got to view the world in some way, that is.
Yes.
And you're either going to accept somebody else's picture or you're going to invent one of your own.
Yes.
And that's how these ideas about social construction also get mixed in with ideas about power, right? So unless you take control of constructing your own reality in the way that you see fit, then you're just imprisoned by somebody else's picture.
That's right. Then another trend of modern thought that's very important is the strong current of what is called philosophical empiricism in modern culture. It's the idea that all of our knowledge comes to us through the senses, right? And this was a very, very important current in philosophy that was really very dominant from the middle of the 17th century until the middle of the 20th century, right? It's especially dominant in the Anglo-speaking countries in England and America. And so all knowledge comes to us through the senses. And that means that we don't know anything but our senses, right? That's one of the correlates of that, is that, well, we don't have any contact with the world, really. We have contact with our senses. We have sense data. And so Alex Racy, guy I've known for years, he's kind of like a theory of mine. Every time I see him, I get very similar sensory inputs. He's a very tall fellow, thin, a certain nose, certain eyes, certain mouth. And they all go around together. It's a very consistent pattern that I've noticed. So I assume there's some kind of bundle there, that something that keeps them all together. But I don't know. All I have are those sensations. And then you had Kant come along, and, you know, out of concern that we don't seem to have access to a real world, he says, yes, there must be a real world behind there somewhere, but the world we are experiencing is largely a construct. It's a construction of our minds. We're imposing time and space and cause and effect. All these things which give our world the regularity and familiarity and comfort that it has. And the great thing is we all do it the same way. And that's why we seem to inhabit a common world. But it's not a real world, right? There's another world out there that must be causing it in the background somewhere. But the physical world we live in is not really the real world.
But, you know, that point is important, though, that for Kant and for other empiricist philosophers, there is a regularity out there,
yes.
Right? So we don't just get to construct any reality we want. There's something that makes it the case that we all see the same thing or experience the same thing. So none of these philosophers so far are really going to go to the point where they say you can construct any reality you want. It's all equally valid. I mean, I think you're right to point out that they do have in common with the constructivists the idea that the mind helps shape reality. But there's a whole different move to the idea that every way of constructing reality would be equally valid.
Well, I think these are all people who are really trying to explain things in a deep way. Locke, Hume, people like this. But they do. I mean, Locke at one point has to say, well, what's the difference between my mind and a madman's mind? It's mainly that his sensations are more vivid than mine. He can't really say that I have more access to the facts. So it's a very hypothetical mode when she observes these patterns.
Well, yes, but I mean...
And Hume goes even further in that direction.
But if we had Locke and Hume here in this room with us, and we said something like, is every way of describing reality equally valid, right? So I say there are three chairs in the room, and somebody says there are five. Neither Hume nor Locke is going to say, yeah, all answers are equally valid. There is an answer to that question for them.
I agree they would say that. But Hume especially would say, well, that's because you're asking me as a regular person. You're asking me as David Hume, the guy who smokes cigars and drinks and has fun in the pub. But when I go into my study and I'm a philosopher, I have no reason to think that any of these things is true, and beyond saying that they are regular. And he makes that point very vividly, that the David Hume, the philosopher, and David Hume, the natural being, are different. And fortunately, nature has not left it up to me to really doubt these things. It's just impossible naturally to doubt them. So really, it's more a point about philosophy, that philosophy has certain limits that it can't go beyond. We can't really take our doubts as seriously as we seem to when we're thinking.
Well, so assuming that there is this sort of germ that's planted by these empiricist philosophers,
yes.
How do we get this transition, do you think, from there to the idea that all ways of constructing reality are equally valid?
Well, it's a cultural rather than a philosophical thing, I would say.
Right. So it's not a logical deduction. It's just, once again, this idea that the idea gets going.
Yes. I mean, already at a point where you've got Kant saying, we construct the way we experience the world. And Kant is writing in the late 18th century and early 19th century. So he's a late 18th century thinker. By the time you get to the 19th century, people are thinking much more crucially about history and the historical difference. You had the French Revolution, the idea of changing culture in a very radical way. So maybe people at different historical periods construct the world differently. They start thinking about that kind of difference. They start thinking more about cultural difference. People are traveling all the world, exploring it, mapping it. And so people are becoming more and more aware of how differently people in other cultures think. So maybe culture is the construction. And then, having already talked all about how the mind shapes reality, people start saying, well, maybe it's language, actually, that imposes a kind of structure on reality. And that was especially a favorite French idea from the early 20th century, structuralism. We have this arbitrarily chosen repertoire of concepts, which we use like a cookie cutter to impose reality upon the world. Society, of course, is another one. Society has its special structures, and it favors certain people, of course. And we impose their privileged view upon the world. Marx made us very aware of class difference and class structure. So all these different kinds of structure that were constructed in various ways by various kinds of people in various places, they all just became powerful instruments of its explanation. People started just explaining the world based on these things, thinking less about facts than about how they are subjectively constructed.
So that seems like largely a historical explanation of the different historical trends that culminate in, yes, in some sort of social constructivist view. Are there more of those that you wanted to mention?
Well, there are a couple more that might be interesting to think about.
Historical trends.
Yes. One is the emergence of nature as a grand construct. Now I'm using their language. But nature became a great moral source in the 19th century. And now people look at nature and the order of nature as a fundamentally good thing. And that's the source of goodness in life. We associate this especially with Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He, in a sense, culminated that trend of culture. The great French philosopher and novelist, musician, probably the key figure in French culture. But going back to nature is a very difficult thing to do, because how do you be natural? The way to be natural is not to impose your will on anything, but just to be yourself, to do it, right? And so if you're hoping that nature will be the savior, it's the kind of thing you want to protect it from human influence, right? The human influence upon nature is how it gets corrupted. So that's another source of this obsession with construction.
So the idea is not that human minds construct reality. The part that we're linking up to here is the worry about accepting other people's constructions.
Yes.
The worry that bad constructions can somehow improperly shape the world or that we should resist them. That's the theme that we're identifying here.
That's right. But then it flips over into another one that just has the idea about God and his will flipped over into human beings and their will.
Mm-hmm.
So the sense of the goodness of nature eventually becomes the sense that, well, isn't nature itself one of these constructs? And aren't people always telling us that things are natural when they're not? So they tell you that heterosexuality is natural and female domesticity is natural and stuff like that. In a way, that has been one of the tendencies of modern culture, which is to use nature as the basis for an ideology. So people are very allergic to the idea. People become very allergic to the idea of appealing to nature as something that has any kind of authority.
I see. So at first it was the worry that we would impose something on nature. Nature is sort of the true right way for things to be. But then eventually people begin seeing nature as its own construct. And now we're pretty close to the idea that there are just a whole bunch of different ways of constructing or seeing reality, all of which are dangerous. Yes. And you've got to be on the lookout and pick one.
That's right.
Well, so that's how historically we get to social constructivism.
That's right.
We haven't yet really identified, though, what the arguments would be for it. I mean, why anyone would actually believe it, because these are not the same thing, right? You can explain historically how hundreds or thousands of years of history led human society to a certain way of thinking, but that's not the same as explaining what the justification is for thinking it that way. So should we talk a little bit about the arguments?
Yes.
You actually highlighted for me an argument for, I guess, what we could call total social constructivism, the idea, yes, that everything's a social construct, that I at least find interesting. And I think it comes from Nietzsche. Is Nietzsche the one who gave the argument about how we're just sort of like flies buzzing,
yes,
around and,
yes,
so on? So the argument, tell me if I get this right, it's something like, imagine some little insect like a fly that's flying around the room and, I don't know, it bumps into the kitchen cabinet and so on. And then you ask yourself, well, how much does this tiny little creature really know about the world? And the answer's got to be it knows basically nothing, right? It's too small and too stupid to figure out any of the real truths of the world.
Yes.
And then Nietzsche's idea is, well, look, we're just tiny little creatures crawling around in our little corner of the universe. And so how much could we really know? I mean, why do we go around claiming that we know truths? Aren't we just likely as completely ignorant and befuddled as the fly that's flying around?
Yes, and he makes this especially vivid by simply noting what a tiny span of time humanity has existed.
Right.
He says, this is actually, you can read this, it's the brilliant first paragraph of his essay, very early essay, on truth and lie in an extra-moral sense. And he talks about these clever animals who were born on a tiny star in a distant planet. And they invented the idea of truth. And then the star cooled and the planet died. And they disappeared. And that was the most audacious bit of pride that ever was created. Because how could these pathetic, short-lived creatures know something like truth, and then imagine every fly that flies through the air. He's flying through his own truth-filled world of his own, and he's just like us.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I feel we have to point out that the argument doesn't quite get us to, like, Latour's form of social constructivism.
No.
Because, you know, when the fly's flying around the kitchen and bumping into the cabinets and so on, there are truths about that world, right? The fly is in a kitchen. It bumped into a cabinet.
Right.
What's going on really is just that the fly is too minuscule and unintelligent to figure out the truths, which is not what social constructivists typically believe. They believe there aren't any truths out there to know. They're all just invented. But Nietzsche's form, and this is why I find this argument interesting, is it's both more modest but also therefore more plausible, because Nietzsche's argument doesn't require that we deny that there are truths out there, but we just have to admit that they're so far beyond the capabilities of little creatures like us that for all intents and purposes,
yes,
we cannot be in contact with the truth, right? And our life is just a matter of constructing beliefs that get us through the day, which will never even approach real truth.
And that's a notion that he pushed through Howard's life. The idea, he called it perspectivalism at times. We all have our own personal perspective, our own way of seeing the world, and we can't get outside it.
Yeah. But see, here I want to slow you down a little bit. I mean, this is not, of course, a criticism of you. It's of Nietzsche or social constructivists. But,
yes.
But often these slogans are put forward, like the one you just put forward, which is that we all walk through life with a way of seeing the world. And you hear that and you think, well, that's got to be true. I guess I'm a social constructivist.
Right.
But then
you realize.
Right. But the mere fact that you have a perspective on the world does not make you a social constructivist,
no.
Right? Of course people have their perspectives, and of course they're limited.
Yes.
But social constructivism in its sort of modern form is a much more radical thesis, that there are no truths out there, and that
yes.
they're just constructed by us.
So I mean, really, there aren't, to me, valid arguments for it, because they all run against that same problem, which is that to be a social constructivist is to give a certain kind of account of how things are. And that account says there's no way that things are. So it's self-contradictory.
Right. You're saying that there are no truths out there. And that statement that I just made is itself a truth. The
right.
truth that there are no truths out there. And this seems contradictory.
Yes.
Or the Nietzsche version of it is you say the truths are too far beyond us because we're so small and incapable of grasping them. And then you say to Nietzsche, but wait, you just stated a truth, which is that we're so small that we can't grasp the truths of the world. And there's this worry that the social constructivists have contradicted themselves.
Many people think of Nietzsche as a nihilist, a person who said there are no values, there's no reality, and so on. And Nietzsche was not comfortable with that idea at all, because he recognized that to think that is really undermine your own power to believe in the world, right? It's a limit on you. Right, if you know that your own ideas are arbitrary or merely self-generated, then you can't believe. And that inability to believe is terribly limiting. Right, it's biologically unpleasant, you might say. Undermines your force. So, in a sense, he hoped for this overman or superman, this character who could create values without being bothered by that. Someone who could get over this conflict between knowing that everything is an arbitrary construction and being inhibited by it.
But that wouldn't resolve the contradiction in the viewpoint. It would just be a hope that one day people will learn to live with the contradiction.
Well, some superman might. And in fact, he almost, at one point, he envisions that as a kind of state of forgetfulness of the past and the forgetfulness of the arguments.
See, I also want to go back to another part of Nietzsche's argument. Because even if he somehow escapes this problem that we're now talking about, this argument by analogy with flies and so on, it has other problems, right? So the reason the fly can't grasp what's going on in the kitchen, or that it's in a kitchen, is that it's so unintelligent. But
yes.
The analogy with humans doesn't work because we're very intelligent. And so I don't know why we should so quickly accept some sort of analogy that we're incapable of understanding truths about the universe, right? I mean, there are undoubtedly things that are beyond us and that we might not figure out before human beings disappear from the universe. But that doesn't mean that we aren't pretty darn smart and haven't figured out a whole lot.
Well, the compensation for being in that dilemma that we mentioned is not only that he can be proud of being able to bear it, but also that it allows him then to go look through all history and diagnose everybody's construction. And you can see what everybody made up, how they made the world up differently, and how these great people like Socrates and Buddha and Jesus, how they were people that invented a whole way of living and world and imposed on other people, and how amazing that is. And Nietzsche would like to be like one of them. So that's the grandiose side that it It allows you to play this grand game of historical diagnosis and self-comparison.
See, it sounds like the only defense you can give of Nietzsche, though, is a kind of psychological one, which is that, sure, his arguments and theories have problems, but here's why they were appealing to him. And I'm happy to accept that they were appealing to him and maybe appealing to other people, but that doesn't make the arguments any better, and it doesn't mean that the rest of us should believe it. Maybe one of the reasons we're having difficulty getting an argument is that we're trying to argue for the most extreme and, frankly, least plausible form of social constructivism.
Yes.
So what about people who are not social constructivists about everything, but, for example, who are social constructivists about the scientific method? Because I think Latour is one of these, right?
Yes.
A person who thinks that the scientific method is no more valid or less valid than any other method of obtaining information or forming beliefs. Have you ever heard decent arguments for this?
No. Well, I mean... There are procedures, simple behaviorism of the most crude sort. I've read Latour's book on what called Laboratory Life. And it's just, Latour goes into the laboratory and he observes the scientists behaving. So they have instruments, they have numbers on them, they make measurements, they have a notebook, they make measurements and write them down in notebooks. They note the time at which the measurement was taken. They make alterations to their materials and so on. They just do stuff. There's no consideration of the result or the thought process at all. And really, this is a kind of quasi-sociological analysis in which basically the scientists have invented all these games they play, which enables them to be in the social role of scientist and to give us results which purport to be scientific. But they're willing to say there's no reason that you should trust these results any more than any other results anybody else might propose. So, I mean, I just don't know what to make of that. I don't see how anyone can say that.
Right. I mean, I'm glad you brought this up because in a way it's the most interesting argument for constructivism about science because there is at least a grain of truth in it. So first of all, of course, you're certainly right that observing that science is a human practice conducted by human beings does not imply that it's only a human practice or that it's made up or that it has no validity. So this argument fundamentally does not work. But when I say there's a grain of truth in it or an insight that's there, it's this. Scientists are human beings, and they have human flaws, and they can make mistakes, and they can be influenced by social agendas.
Yes.
And they can do terrible science in the service of popular ideas and so on. All of that's true, and it's very important. And scientists would be some of the first people to tell you that it's important. In fact, an awful lot of what scientists do is designed to try to protect their own research from their own human flaws.
Right.
So that's a deep and interesting point. It won't get us to social constructivism about science, but in order to give some credit to the social constructivists, I think we should note that that's a very important insight. And of course, science has been used in horrible ways in the past, right?
Yes.
Science has been used to justify all kinds of terrible things, and it's worth having a skeptical eye to see if that's happening again in the present day.
Although you are speaking as if we actually learned that from social constructivists. That's something that's been pointed out many times by people who didn't have that position, who didn't take it that far.
That's right. I guess the credit I would give to the social constructivists is that they took that insight and sort of put it on steroids and
made it absurd.
Right. They gave it steroid rage or something like that.
Yes.
But I guess, you know, you can imagine a time in, say, the 19th century, or this would have been true of parts of the 20th century, too, where there might have been scientists, for example, who claimed to have confirmed that men are a certain way, women are a certain way, and really what they were doing is just describing the gender stereotypes of their era.
Right.
And even though people in science had known since the beginning of science that it was conducted by human beings and subject to human fallibility, I think there was certainly a period when science seemed more authoritarian about certain things, and it did take certain groups, including social constructivists, to come along and say, let's be a little more skeptical about some of this science. So I give them a little bit of credit there, although you're certainly right. It then goes to an absurd extreme where the scientific method is viewed as no more valid than anything else.
And, you know, I know people who are attracted to this theory. It's become popular in literary studies now.
Constructivism in general.
And not only constructivism, but also the thing that Latour himself does, which is actor network theory. And actually, this is almost unbelievable, but Latour's idea is that we've made a mistake in describing science because we've taken the scientist to be an actor in some way that is superior to the other components of science. for instance, the actual materials we work on. And they should be thought of as actors, too. So in a famous case study written by a man named Michael Callan, which we're often cites, he describes how some New England businesses, they hired scientists to go to Japan and study shrimp and how shrimp in Japan are farmed in the sea. The Japanese developed these beds with certain kinds of nests, boxes of some kind, and the shrimp go in there and they feed and they grow and they multiply and then they can be harvested without having to chase them around in the sea, right? So these scientists...
Did people ever chase shrimp around in the sea?
Well, I'm showing my ignorance of my ignorance of shrimp farming.
Understood.
But anyway, well, no, I think, you know, I mean, you know, they're not shrimp everywhere. You're going to find them. Right?
Maybe this is a subject for another podcast.
Could be.
We'll look up shrimp farming.
Shrimp farming. Actually, people don't realize that shrimp farming is socially constructed. I'm going to explain that.
Okay.
But so they tried to transplant these techniques to New England, but for some reason, the shrimp would not cooperate. And they wandered away from these nests.
Uh-huh.
And so they're agents, too. And we should not think of them as being any less agents than the scientists who study them.
Okay.
And so we really need to undermine this notion of a difference of actors and mere materials.
And I'm sorry, maybe I'm just not getting it. How does this get us to social constructivism? I mean, sure, the shrimp are living creatures and sometimes they don't cooperate. And then how do we get to the idea that...
Well, I don't understand how it's related to social constructivism. And in fact, LaTour, one of these guys who comes up with very counterintuitive positions and then makes a whole career out of energetically defending them. But people find this somehow pleasantly dethroning to science. And I find that troubling because I'm rather attached to science and its technologies and other things that it makes possible.
Yeah.
And knowledge it provides. And I'm also very aware that in our world, we're surrounded now by people who are denying the validity of science for very bad reasons, and it has a very damaging effect, climate denial being a particularly egregious example.
Right.
But there's an anti-authoritarianism that is deeply embedded in modern culture, and social constructivism is one of the expressions of it.
Right, and I think we should at least pause to note that the anti-authoritarian tendency, that might be something that we don't want to criticize. I mean, there are all kinds of people who are subject to all sorts of horrible things in the world, right? And
yes.
They want to resist the various authorities and power structures that do the bad things. There's nothing wrong with that. That's just sort of standing up for justice. And then the question is how you do this. So one way you can do it intellectually is to say, well, look, authorities, we don't believe what you're saying because nothing is really true or false. Nothing has any validity, so we don't have to believe what you're saying. That would be the social constructivist way of fighting the message that the authorities are sending.
Yes.
But there's another way, which is to fight what the authorities are saying with facts, right? So if the authorities say this or that group is inferior, you fight back with facts and say, no, they're not. Or if the authorities say there's no such thing as climate change, you fight back with facts and say, no, it's real. Let me prove it to you, right? The anti-authoritarianism, though, the need to resist the bad things of the world, that's not something that we should criticize, I think. But it's just a question of then how you manifest that intellectually. Do you say that my anti-authoritarianism leads me to be a social constructivist, or does it lead me to fight bad facts with good facts?
Well, when I hear the word anti-authoritarianism, that seems to be a kind of mindset which needs to find authorities to resist. I don't think you should be anti or pro-authority per se. I think you should see what people are saying first and then decide whether it should be believed or not. I mean, it's extreme anti-authoritarianism that leads people to say there are no facts, and if I have to accept that my own position is non-factual, I'll lump it because there's no choice. I don't want to leave anybody any space for making any kind of valid assertion. And that really is an absurd position to be in. Latour's explanation for everything is that, well, people are just doing this to create an authority structure and an institutional structure for themselves. And he makes the point that we normally associate this kind of anti-authoritarian critique as leftist. And he certainly is in that category himself. But he now, in 2005, begins to notice that some people on the left are taking this awfully far. For instance, putting forward the hypothesis that 9/11 was an entirely faked or constructed event. And this starts to make him uncomfortable. And of course, we've seen this since then on the right as well, that this rise of a new flexibility, shall we say, when it comes to matters of fact. Fake news, alternative facts, and so on.
Yeah. Not everyone on the right, but some people.
Yes. And we've come to see now that the media environment seems to make ideas that are circulating around very important in a way that's just divorced from their truth or falsehood. And Latour is troubled by that. But the funny thing is, you know, he feels troubled in a way that is somewhat helpless because having denied the existence of facts for so many years, he doesn't really have a ground to stand on in making a complaint.
I feel my heart cry, don't let the love die. Is this the last time? Are we out of time? Is this the right time?